Okay, so welcome everyone to the I think we're at 15. This should be episode 15. We're at episode 15 of Fan Ostwärts, or as this is our first English episode, we should probably say Far Eastwards. Today Nils isn't here. Instead, we found a very knowledgeable replacement for him. This is Julien. Say hello.
Hi, I'm Julien.
Julien is basically studying the same degree as I am. So he's also studying Eurasia relations, and we studied in France together for 2 years. And he's now in Beijing with me. And we'll be talking about urbanism and urban design and urban planning today.
Exactly.
Do you just anything else that I should be saying about you that's important or
Well, first of all, I didn't study anything in urban planning design yet. I'm planning on doing it, but I didn't actually study anything on it yet. It's more about my interests, and I did a few internships, and I read a lot of stuff about it, but it's more like a, some of interest and stuff I've read and ideas I've taken from people. So yeah, that's it.
At least, like, I mean, I've spoken to him about these topics, right? So I know that he explained a lot of things to me that I didn't know before. So I think, like, none of our listeners do have any basis, like, or I think that most of them won't have a basis in this topic. So I think it's gonna be fine. Also, I don't know if you know this, but you've got the honor of being our first guest on this show. So before, it was always Nils and me, and now in episode 15, like, it's the first time for someone from the outside to kind of come in.
Okay.
So
I hope
yeah,
I'll be good
it's
enough.
gonna be exciting. Okay, so let me just I'm missing chapter marks again. So we're at 2 minutes now, and so let's start with, like, we're talking about, like, we said urban planning, urban design, and urbanism.
Urbanism.
Can you maybe tell me what the difference is between the three?
Yes, I can try and tell difference because at first myself I didn't really get it. I was thinking that urbanism was very naively, I was thinking it was just about managing the city, laying out new cities, and thinking about how to efficiently better organize and efficiently allocate resources and stuff like this. Actually, when I came to China, I realized that in English and in Chinese, you don't really say urbanism. It's actually more of a term that I've encountered in French, and I think it's linked to actually cultural perception of what urbanism or urban planning is. I think Chinese people like urban planning best because that's what teachers and specialists usually refer to as managing the city, because they have a really strong history in basically planning, not only in urban, economic planning and government planning. So for them, it's better. Whereas ism in Chinese, translated as ideology, is the so for them, if you say urbanism, it would be more like Marxism, capitalism. So it's something that should urbanism, how cities should be. Urban planning is like how to manage cities. So it's a difference in concept. And urban design is the is close to urban planning, but it's more like not about allocating resources, but more like how to design the city in a way that's gonna be more comfortable to live in, efficient, but like through design, not out of nothing. So that's how I understand it.
Okay, fair enough. Would you mind just telling me how you started looking into this topic at all? Like, why did you start looking into urban planning? Is there, like, a specific reason?
I've always wanted to I wasn't always interested by big cities. It's very basic, but I've always lived in big cities, and at first I wanted to be an architect, and then I diverted towards more, international relations and political science issues, and then I realized that I really like sociology about it. And then when you link this kind of, architecture or like the city and how the buildings, like what's the building place and role in a city, and then actually it's actually more interesting to look at it as a system than just like a series of building. And that's when I realized it was basically last year or 2 years ago that it was actually something that I liked. I could actually merge this kind of sociology interest and architecture interest into urban planning or urbanism. And then I did an internship in India, and then I realized that it was something that I like researching, because it was basically more about research about urban structures and how did people adapt to urban structures and change urban structures. Mm. And that's what really interested me, and I think that's what set me on the course to study more about it.
Mm. So essentially, like, this whole sociology aspect comes in there, where it's about the interaction of us as people who live in a city with the with essentially everything that's around us, and like the whole, yeah, like the city as a whole.
Because the city is there before us in a way, but it's also there because someone designed it that way, yeah, and it evolved that way. Maybe it wasn't taught as something like how it is today. It wasn't taught as something as a whole system, mm-hmm, at first, but it evolved that way, and now it's that way. So the interesting thing is to see how it evolved that way, mm-hmm, and why it evolved that way, and then try and guess how it will evolve in the future, and maybe impact on it, so it will evolve in some way that we think is, mm-hmm, better and more efficient, or more like whatever we're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Then I've just got a follow-up question there. What would be a metric or a criterion for saying this is good urban design, this is good urban planning? Are there goals where you say these are something that, like, everyone says should be done? Like, mm-hmm, sustainability, I guess?
Yes. Obviously, this what is good in urban planning has been evolving across, mm-hmm, years. But, I mean, if you're on the latest trends, what I see more online and in reports and everything is more like, today is more about sustainable cities, mm-hmm, how to make them more resilient to climate change. This, mm-hmm, is the latest thing, like how do existing city can be changed and designed in a way that next disaster that will come by, it will be less a problem or less destructive. So this is the concept of resilient cities. So this is very interesting, actually. But like more classic is about how to make cities less energy consuming, mm, more efficient, and like energy wise, but also like transportation, how to make it easier for people to live in it, mm, make people happier. But origin, like in China, I don't think it's just emerging. Like, mm, these kind of topics are pretty much there, but not really applied yet. I think it was more about how to manage the flow of people coming into the cities.
Because
there's so many, so they have lots and lots of regulations specific to China about this. But it's like, you know, the environment sustainability is coming, mm, in, and but I think it's pretty much still centered on, like, you know, how to manage people and how to make it economically efficient.
Mm, okay, fair enough. So, I mean, that's essentially, like, we're at your first, like, point there that you have, like, about introducing urban China.
Mm.
I mean, we all know that China is urbanizing incredibly quickly, and that also poses a lot of problems for the environment, yes, but it also poses problems for cities, right?
Yeah, and the thing that's amazing with China is that no country ever in history had urbanized that quickly before.
Okay.
So the thing is that, you know, if you see urbanization, mass urbanization arrives in Europe, well, there was big cities before in medieval times and everything, but it was not the same pace.
Mm.
Xi'an in central China and Tang Dynasty was more than 1 million people, which, mm, is enormous for the time. But it was, I mean, it's not the same scale at all, and, yeah, we don't know much about that time. But like the first massive urbanization that we can call like more like closer to us, more contemporary, mm, was basically the Industrial Revolution. So it started in Britain, but there in Britain, in Germany, in France, and then afterwards in France and the U.S., it spanned a relatively long time, like 70 to 100 years. Mm. To achieve what the urbanization level that China did in 30 to 40 years, I would say. So, I mean, when I say urbanization level, I mean like the number, mm, the percentage of the population, yeah, that actually lives in urban areas.
Yeah.
And in China, it grew really fast, even though they were still trying to limit it. And, mm, it, you know how the economic development is so fast, and everything is going faster. Well, urbanization is also an aspect of this mm, kind of really super speed development. So, yeah, obviously it has lots of like challenges, but also brings lots of opportunities.
Mm.
And it's interesting for us and those that study the cities that you can actually see everything unraveling under your eyes much quicker. You don't, yeah, have to wait so long to see stuff happening. But then, of course, they have to face problems that Europeans faced in the first 20 years of urbanization, and then they resolved it, and then they faced another one.
Yeah.
The Chinese cities are actually facing everything together. Like, they're trying to be sustainable environmentally, whereas they're still integrating hundreds and hundreds of millions of migrant workers and people that have never heard about sustainability and environmental issues before. So it's much, the situation is completely different.
Yeah, I think that's something that maybe you don't realize when you're in Europe, that the pace of change in China, it's to a certain extent already cliche or a stereotype, but it's very, like, it's impressive. I remember I remember traveling through Lanzhou in central China, and we went to a restaurant that was like around the corner from the station, and we came through the same city, I think 7 days later, and essentially the whole area where the restaurant had been had just been knocked down. And I saw the same in Shanghai. And like, you go, like, also that's like something that people often say about travel guides for China, like, if it's older than a year, even if it's only 6 months old, you can expect that a lot of things aren't true anymore, because buildings are just being knocked down and are like being replaced with new things.
And this is like, it impacts everything about it's not just about urbanism, it's about everything in China. But
that's
So
when you say there's a lot of opportunities, because we often, we mainly hear about the bad things about urbanization, right? Like, there's a lot of people crowded together, hygiene problems, slums. What are the opportunities?
Well, there's all these problems, but people still keep coming, right? So there must be a good thing about living in a city. I mean, just to put in a number in there, I think urbanization level in China is about 60% now, or not yet, but soon to be 60%. When China arrived to the 50% of people living in cities, that's when basically the world arrived to 50% as well, like around the same year. So just to say, like, I think 1 or 2 years, it's the first time in human history that more than half of the human population lives in city.
Wow.
And that's when also when China achieved that level as well.
Yeah.
Exactly around the same time. But China is going faster than the world average. So yeah, what about opportunities in urban China? Well, people still keep coming to cities, basically always, has always been the same reason, is to find some job.
Mm-hmm.
So unemployment, and you get more opportunities, and you get like job opportunities, and you get, the salaries are always higher.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, it still attracts people, even though they get to live in these conditions that are sometimes really harsh.
Mm.
But then opportunities are so, I mean, more than for the migrant who comes to the cities, there's also like more macroeconomic opportunities. It's like people, more people in cities means that actually you can have cheaper laborers in the cities. And this is also important to the growth of cities. Like the percentage of population, migrant population who's contributing to the boom in construction in like Beijing or Shanghai or big cities is enormous. And if you didn't have these migrant illegal populations that coming and are paid really nothing for it, like, I mean, the cost of construction will actually be higher, I guess.
Okay.
And also at some point these people get richer and then they consume more.
Mm.
And it's really one of the points of the government right now is to change the growth model from export-oriented, because China is trying to get a bit over that now, into something that's more consumer-oriented. And to do that, they really bet on urbanization levels and the fact that everyone's going to be urban. And because urban, when you're urban, you consume more.
There's
a center of consumptions. And there's lots of these factors. So opportunities for the people that move in, opportunities for the government, and like, oh, it's basically economic opportunities.
Okay. So I think also something, maybe we should explain the hukou system, because like the notion of illegal migrants within a country is not really existent in the West, right?
Yes. Maybe I should have talked about this a bit before, because I forgot.
No worries.
It's something that's so obvious in China now that you don't even realize that other people sometimes like never heard about it.
Yeah.
But it's the hukou system is basically the policy that China put in place in the earliest times of communist China, so it was in early 50s, to restrict migration flows within China. So basically the idea was like, people that are in the city should be kept in the cities, and people that are in the countryside should be kept in the countryside, and so that it's easier to plan the country's economy that way, and it's easier to control.
Mm.
So people that are in what is classified as urban areas get urban hukous, So HUKO is basically a certificate or a residence permit, I would say.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
A residence permit that gives them access in urban areas to urban welfare system. So they get access to hospital, education for the kids, and the kids get to be authorized to go to pass examinations and go to universities. And if these people, for the people that live in the countryside in areas that are classified as rural areas, then they get rural hukous, logically, and which does not give them access to urban welfare system. And since the welfare system facilities are not developed in rural areas, they do not, like, they are less developed in rural areas, they get less access to health care facilities and education. So most people with rural hukou are actually want to get to cities to benefit from all these advantages. The thing is that if they move to cities and they don't have the urban hukou, they are considered illegal immigrants and do not get access to any of these things, but still can have the opportunities of having a better job.
Yeah, and like getting a higher salary.
But this system is worth mentioning, is under complete reform right now. And it's a very historical thing. It's actually being softened, meaning that the urban-rural distinction in hukou is getting erased.
Mm.
So not for big, big cities like the richest cities, Beijing, Shanghai, and all the coastal cities, but within provinces like small cities and urban hukou will be merged. So that basically, I think it happened in some of the provinces, like I think Heilongjiang in the north, but some provinces are experimenting with it. And basically, it will give access to, like, equal access to all the welfare system to everyone. And this is possible because China is developing now and can actually provide more welfare services to everyone. But I mean, the evolution is still very low, and it's still limiting migration to the big cities. Otherwise, if this would not be the case, then you would have cities with much, much more people nowadays, and you would have probably really big slums and really big and enormous migrant communities in very poor conditions. I'm not saying it's a good thing to limit like a freedom of circulation and move around.
Yeah.
But I mean, the rationale behind this policy was basically to limit so you can control and like try and control urbanization process, and then like, you know, step by step move towards like a regularization.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, that's the same thing as with the one child policy. We tend to see it negatively in the West, but at the same time, economically, it was a very rational choice in China.
Yeah, it was seen as a necessity.
Exactly. Like, it's like, can't do anything about it. So you were mentioning slums already. So, yes. And you wanted to talk about that. You said it's something you're really interested in.
Yes.
What is there to talk about when it comes to the fringes of the city in China?
Yeah.
And also in comparison to other Asian countries.
Yeah, sure. It's a topic I really like because it's one of the first topics I encountered when I started my internship in Mumbai this summer. And like, even the concept of the word of slum is used, widely used today by everyone, but it's a bit derogatory.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you say slum, you think, you know, some place that's probably dirty, that doesn't have electricity, no water. People are living in horrible conditions, and what they should do is just, when they have the money, just move out and everything. The thing is that slums are basically just areas that are not legal. Buildings, habitats, or houses, basically, that are not legal. They're residences. So people live there because they have no choice, and so they end up there because they migrate. So whatever the country, they usually, there's some huge famous slums in Brazil, for example, favelas that are built on illegal places because these places are mountains. So there's no authorization for construction, so they go there and build their houses there. But in China, it's the same thing, but lesser extent because of the hukou system, but it still exists. And people come from the countryside, they can't find a house, so they just settle in this area and build their own house with the scrap they can find. And actually, either they build from nothing, or they build on existing buildings that were around. So especially in China, cities grow super fast.
Yeah.
And they tend to absorb in their growth villages that were once rural and they're on the fringes of the city. And then get completely deprived of their agricultural land, and are therefore reduced, villagers are therefore reduced to rent some of their rooms to these migrant workers who come in, settle there, and then with the money of these they get from the rent, they actually extend their buildings, densify the area, which still has the like street grid of a little village and no big streets and everything, but it's getting densified and becomes what we call urban villages. So you have more, China's more a kind of urban village country where you have these kind of villages that have been swallowed and densified rather than like slums that were built out of scraps. You you have these slums as well, but they're to a lesser extent, I think, because of the hukou system that limits mass migration. So you have these urban villages that are really interesting fringes because they were built to be agricultural settlements, because they were agricultural settlements, like they were, it was a village. They were swallowed in, so they still have the structure, but they just densify, they add floors. And there are very, like, completely unauthorized add-ons on their houses.
Oh, okay, so it's all illegal. It's, like, they just add, like, a floor and just, like,
Build it and then just to rent more, too.
Yeah.
And then the migrants just came in, and then some migrant might want to, you know, open up, has some tailor, he's a tailor back home, so he's just going to open a little workshop by renting this little home and, like, have their own little business going on there, and it creates this kind of fringe neighborhoods that are completely not thought or they're not recognized by the government, so they're not even the government when plans the area beforehand will not think like I'm gonna have to put electricity for these villages, because these villages are not supposed to be there, or just like a few houses, and it's just over cramming population in some of these small villages.
So is electricity and like water, is that a problem in these areas?
Well, I guess it must be, but I think they divert electricity from where they can find it. I don't know. I've never heard about it in China really, but in India, where I studied the slums, the electricity is diverted from the lines, so they just steal the electricity from the lines most of the time, and they don't have any water, they don't have toilets or bathrooms, so it's just like they share some area, but electricity is illegally used, and there's not enough electricity, so usually there's power cuts and everything. But they're really interesting is that these neighborhoods evolve by themselves, and in the case of India where I was studying, what I was studying is the evolution of this area, which became this really like a slum made out of scraps, and then people get more money because they're in city and they have the job, so they upgrade their houses, and then they start building houses out of like bricks, and then the houses are getting better, and then they install electricity that's maybe just stolen but still the electricity, and then sometimes they will even put some kind of bathroom, you know, there won't be like a full flush toilet and everything, but you know, they start getting things better, and then they decide to pave the road because everyone goes together and pave the road and have to cooperate about it, and then they decide that they should have it's the way they live, so they should have this religious place of worship. But then like, okay, I'm a Muslim and this is a Muslim family. We want a mosque, but then we don't have enough money, so we should team up with these Hindu guys so that we can like have this kind of place of worship where we can basically have a room for the Muslims and a room for the Hindus. And like, you know, it depends on each slums, but the fact is that they have to organize each other, and the city comes out of like it's unplanned.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't really like to say I'm studying urban planning, because what I really thought was interesting is that it was unplanned, but out of necessity, these people collaborated and made something out of it. And they had their own networks, and you know, then they rent out to some guy who's gonna have a business activity, and you know, the life's there. And the problem is that both in China and in India, the government's reaction to this is when they want to develop the land, they were just gonna destroy what was built there.
Oh, well, okay.
To replace it with basically big development, or you know, like.
Like a building, like the one we're in right now with like 20 floors and like five buildings right next to each other.
Losing completely all this, the grid of the village and like the social interaction that's been developed and the cooperation, for example, between religions that have been developed. Also in the slums, interesting thing is that you realize that actually people have to take care of themselves. So women have to take care of their houses. And actually, if you compare, especially in India, like the gender equality is actually better in slums than in like
communes,
because like you know the woman has to manage the money, because the guy, she has to also earn some money, and like you out of necessity, like, you have interesting stuff happening.
Yeah.
And when you replace it without studying it, sometimes you lose some of this that you can actually, it's not 100% bad about it. So that's interesting thing. And these homegrown neighborhood, how you can call it that way because you're homegrown by the people that live in it, can actually survive these stages of development. And if you take one example I thought was really interesting, I've never been there, but maybe you have, is in Tokyo. It's called Shimokitazawa.
Oh, yeah.
Is a neighborhood that did follow the kind of same path at the beginning that those slums were, the urban villages were.
Yeah.
It was, I think, rural area at first, and then it also developed by itself, like the inhabitants also. It was completely left out of planning after the World War. When they developed the city like mad, like when in the big growth of Japan, it was
after World War II.
Yeah, obviously, and it was left out, and it survived in some way, and now it's super famous because it has these little streets and little like street grids, and there's a lot of activity. Like, it's been a bit specialized in, I think, creative and music and maybe artists that live there.
It's
it's become a trendy neighborhood, kind of.
It's kind of like, it's a bit like hipster parts of Berlin, to be honest.
Yeah, but like, why are these parts appealing? Because they're different from the big like avenues with buildings. They're like human scale, different. You can like just walk through it, and then there's like these houses have been developed by their own people, and etc. So I think that we could apply this thinking on some of the homegrown neighborhoods in China or in India, and then, like, you know, keep the scale, keep the fact that people are creating their neighborhood themselves in the way they actually like to live. So it's probably going to be better life quality if you just add electricity and put like water systems and sewage system, and then keep it developing by itself, maybe like making sure that safety is there and fire safety is accessible.
Yeah.
But then otherwise, leave it grow,
yeah,
and then it can do something that's maybe more valuable in the end, more sustainable maybe than the big.
They're like the big thing that like government is just like putting there.
Yeah,
actually, one thing I think is interesting is also that it shows how, because I think in the West we tend to perceive slums as a place where people go and then essentially they're lost, right? Slum is a place where you go and then you will be poor for the rest of your life. But when you talk about these areas, that actually means that the economic opportunity of cities is actually very real for the people who live there, because they manage to like get that extra money and manage to like change the places they live in. So that's like something relevant to note.
Well, they're still poor and live in conditions that we would not be able to live in. But I mean, the thing is that even in the West for a long time, it was just slums are, you know, good to be destroyed and replaced. Mm. And actually, now you can actually realize that, no, sometimes there's something nice you can make. Some may be better off being destroyed because they're really like maybe build in some place that's dangerous or something.
Yeah, and also, I mean, depending on the stage of development then, right? If the slum is, like, in the very early stage where life conditions are real, like, still really bad and the, like, standard of living is incredibly low, then it might be better not, like, because you know that maybe it's going to take, like, 10 years until everything gets better, so it might be preferable to save people now and, like, help them now.
Yeah, and the additional factor in China is that these neighborhoods are not going to be, the urban planning goes on, the urban planning process goes on from a top to bottom, a bit like everything in China. It's like there's not much of popular voice opinion in it. They don't really ask for the opinion of people that lived there before.
Yeah, no, that's not how the country works.
I mean, even India is not really an example in it, but still has this tradition of, you know, a bit more democratic than you could. People have a say most of the time it's not taken into account.
Yeah.
But they do have a say. There's no such channel in China, so it seems really hard to imagine any evolution towards something that could look like Shimokitazawa in the future, or any kind of trendy neighborhoods. Now it's more like it's just going to be destroyed.
You said you have like a place in Mumbai and a place in Beijing that you think might be interesting to compare. What were you thinking about there?
It was just the comparison was between the slum I was working in Mumbai, it was called Shivaji Nagar, was built on public so dump site, like when you put the
Oh,
waste.
yeah.
So the houses are literally built on mountains of waste.
Wow.
Or yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Waste that comes from the city, you know, hundreds and hundreds of kilos of trucks. And there's mixed mountains and actually stuff grows on it like grass.
Well, to
And
a
it's
certain
being
extent.
built on it, and it's, you know, it becomes kind of the solid earth
Yeah.
afterwards, and it's just another neighborhood's more than just scraps. It has brick houses and everything, so it's pretty impressive. And this, and it's developing quite to into something that's quite respectable now. It paved some of the main roads, and you know, but it's still based on a big dump site. And Dongxiaokou is an area in Beijing. I've never been actually, but it's a community of illegal migrant workers that is specialized in, you know, these people that pick up the trash in the street. That's actually where they live, and they like back there. They bring that back to Dongxiaokou, and Dongxiaokou is basically also one kind of a dump ground where they actually do
Like the
the
sorting.
sorting. Yeah, they sort it. So this family that comes from, I don't know, Hunan province, is specialized in like plastic and like, you know, this kind of plastic, and then
Yeah.
the other one is specialized in like metal parts of bikes, and they all like have their own little thing. So it like I thought it was interesting because both are based, like, make a living and a society that are based on basic garbage of the bigger city. So
Yeah.
it's very much a fringe, like,
And very
you
much a
know.
product of the city.
Yeah, and it's you don't really think about how where these things end up, but actually people live out of it and make full, like, almost independent societies out of these, you
Like what
know,
we just throw away,
what
essentially.
we just throw away. So yeah, and but that I think is where the comparison stops, because I didn't go to Dongxiaokou, so I
Yeah.
cannot. But it's a way, like. So you can see like how the fringes are most of the time invisible, but actually it's where most of the interesting urban innovation happens. Like
Because also
community basically living on recycling. I mean, it's
I mean, I guess as
they could
well.
develop that kind of thing for sustainability. Like if they would, I don't know.
And I guess it's also because in the city centers, it's like the city tends to be denser. It tends to be already very crowded, and there's not much possible. Like there's not much potential for development, right? I mean, like even where we are living now, which is within the fourth ring road,
With the fifth,
or fifth,
we're
within
going
the
to the
fifth ring
fourth, yeah.
road, of Beijing, it's still very, like it's. I don't think there's much space. There's hardly anything you could really change about the neighborhood we live in.
Yeah, you can't really change anything about it because it's been already planned,
Yeah.
and Beijing is so planned. Beijing is just like
Oh yeah.
is the socialist city by excellence. Like, I think the Soviet couldn't dream of something better. Like when Mao Zedong arrived in power, he basically asked a Soviet help for designing of this new capital, Beijing. And I think they had much more leeway here than they had back home, because back home, basically the big cities were not that much eager to destroy their old centers than Mao Zedong was.
And
And
Mao
Mao
was
Zedong
just like,
was
oh.
actually said, like, you can do whatever you want, like we can destroy whatever you need.
Wow.
Well, I don't think he would have destroyed this Forbidden City, but like, I mean, a lot of destruction happens there, and it has been remodeled really for these ideological and political purpose in a way that's now unerasable in Beijing. It's like it's been it, the whole city, the core city, core of the city has structure of the city has been developed in that time, and it's grown enormously in that time. So now it's super hard to change it, even if they wanted to.
Yeah.
And sometimes, some places they want to, because you know, we've realized after some time that the socialist idea of the city sometimes is not really as livable as it was meant to be. Like, you know, so Beijing is characterized by these enormous avenues and
Yeah.
you know, unwalkable distances,
Oh, yeah, that's true.
and the city's grand, the city's all functional and all concrete, but it's not livable, and it lost some of, you know, the density. It lost the small streets. It lost, well, they're still existing, but these are in the remaining parts of old Chinese town.
Although it should be said that the small streets that are left are being erased one by one now as well. It's yes. like they still exist in the city center, but they're being knocked down and replaced with like high... I'm not sure if they're being replaced with high-rise buildings, but...
No, I think they're probably just being replaced by what they deem is probably something that's cleaner and yeah, better adapted. Because these places are now centered in Beijing, Beijing, so they have really a high land value, and they just want to do something that's economically more efficient about it. Mm. That's how they justify it.
It's interesting though, but because you've got the communists talking about economic efficiency, right? And like, it sounds very, very capitalist.
Well, now it's completely like, you know, changed, but like, yeah, but they don't build these big socialist style kind of cities now. Mm. Now what they build is the result is sometimes the same, like enormous streets and big buildings.
Mm.
But the reason is, I think, different. It's more like, because we have to accommodate so many people.
Mm, yeah.
It's just, I think this is just something they can't really avoid, right? So, yeah. But as far as the old city of Beijing, they still have some areas that have been dedicated and protected. But the problem with that is that as soon as they protect one area, then it's like, okay, we protect this area, so now we can destroy this one.
Oh, okay.
So it's a bit like, oh, we've done this, so we've protected this really little historical street.
Mm.
Maybe because this one's the most important because it's the most famous one.
Mm.
And then the one next to it, which is equally nice, but it's not as famous, is going to be sacrificed for.
Yeah, okay.
The other one has been restored.
It sounds very Chinese.
And also being transformed into some touristic attraction.
Yeah.
And the other one that's been still living with, you know, local people, maybe old people playing, you know, in the street cards, and, you know, Chinese people have a genius to occupy the street they live in, especially old people. Well, these kind of streets are going to be probably erased, most of it, or transformed into touristic attractions, but probably not, will not stay as they are.
Yeah, that's like...
a city that doesn't change is really not possible. So, I mean, even if you don't like the change, it's not really...
Of course, but then again, the question is like, do you think there's an inherent value to keeping parts of the city intact? Like, is there an inherent value to keeping you essentially, because this is like these older parts of Beijing are part of Beijing's history, right? They're part of like how the city was planned at the time. Do you think there's a value to keeping those parts, or do you think it's more important to get rid of them and make it like maybe more efficient and also like possibly also more livable, because the sewage system is really not amazing and like hygiene conditions are not amazing in a lot of these hutongs?
There's still definitely a value in keeping them, the old parts of Beijing city. And what I think is missed, but it don't really, it's not really incorporated in the protection plans, is that what's interesting sometimes in some areas, not so much the building in itself, but more about the system of building, the networks of, you know, buildings, this aligning in the street that's, oh my God, it's not right. Maybe it's curvy, and that's what's nice about it.
Yeah.
And it's curving because it has this building that's that way, because this family added something. And, you know, if you just homogenize everything, then it kills the vibe. And there's also the other interesting thing is that the street grid is interesting, especially in Chinese cities, because it was planned actually a long time ago. They had urban planning for a long time. So they have this kind of planning, that the grid that doesn't correspond today. So, I mean, even though they recognize some value in the historical sites, they don't really recognize yet, or maybe they do, but it's not really seen, the value of the whole system, a network of street. And that's what most, because they know that they have to keep their old buildings. I mean, they're not stupid, but it's just like they consider history maybe more as something that's immaterial than more material. So like the fact that there was this old building there, as long as they know it, and maybe they will just rebuild something, maybe not new, but you know, sometimes they say, oh, this temple has been there for 5,000 years. Yeah. And you're like, how come? It's in wood. And they're like, oh yeah, it burned like 25 times and it was rebuilt. Yeah. And it's like, so the last version is from 1930. And like,
but they still say it's the same temple.
Exactly. So they don't have the same, for us Western people, it's really like the material, the stone has been here for 5,000 years.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. But for them, it's more like there has been a stone that has been having this function of like worship here for 5,000 years. So like the place is more about the place and why is it there was a temple there, and so probably feng shui is good, and lots of other elements that come into it.
Oh yeah, feng shui. How much? Okay, I think most Westerners pronounce it feng shui or
feng shui.
Feng shui.
Yes.
And Chinese it would be feng shui. How much does that play into city planning in China?
Oh, that's a good question, because actually, feng shui is just to put back into context for those who don't know. Feng shui means literally wind and water, and it's the concept according to which Chinese architects and planners, and actually Chinese just people in general, organize themselves in space. So they're going to build a house in this space because it has good feng shui. So what's good feng shui is it's in an area that balances energies that you can't really perceive, but are like more like spiritual energies. Like they have, has to have a mountain somewhere and water. Usually mountain and water is the most important to, in order to build a city, for example. The best is to have like mountains behind and like to the north, and like water in front, so to the south. And then if you have this kind of area, then it's the perfect place to build a city.
Oh, okay.
For example, that's why maybe like, that's the reason why Beijing is here and not like 100 kilometers somewhere else. It's, but like, you know, sometimes it's just adapt feng shui. Yeah. And feng shui also has, you know, city scale. There's city scale feng shui. There's also like, you know, in the room, Chinese people will never, I don't know, have, they always face the door. The bed faces the door or something.
Yeah.
In order, because for them, like if the head is in direction of the door or something, it impacts like everything about spatial organization.
Yeah, like one thing I was told, for example, by my roommates in Shanghai is that their room had very bad feng shui because it was right opposite of the front door. So like you would open the door that like you would be walking towards their room, and that would be very bad feng shui, because kind of like the bad energy would be able to come in the door and then would be like go right into their room.
Directly, yeah.
Yeah.
And also this still impacts today's urban planning in some ways. It's like, for example, if they have big projects, like for example, the one you can think about is Shenzhen. In Shenzhen, which is a city in the south, they built this brand new, it's a city that's been booming, that wasn't there 4 years ago.
It's right next to Hong Kong. That's probably important to know.
Yeah. It's basically, that's why it's been booming so fast.
Mm.
It's, it has grown in 40 years from like 200,000 people to 10 million.
Mm.
So it's probably the city that's been growing the fastest in human history. And Shenzhen is, has a new town hall that was designed in probably in the 2000s or the 1990s. And what I can think about is that they placed the town hall so that it like it has the mountain, which is kind of one of the iconic mountains of Shenzhen, and to the back, yeah, and then the sea to the front.
Oh.
And you know, they built like the shape so that, you know, it echoes the mountain, and it's not something that we wouldn't do because okay, it's nice, but yeah, for them it has, you can add this functional dimension that makes it like auspicious.
Okay.
And it's not like they worship feng shui, but if it's good feng shui, it's always nice.
Mm.
It's something that they always take into account.
Although, I mean, I don't know, like, for example, my roommate in Shanghai was convinced that the bad feng shui of her room was the reason she always had a cold in winter. So, like, it also, to, like, I think it's probably a different degree in, for different people.
Yeah.
But in that case, it amounted to some kind of superstition, I think, because, like, we did not have heating in our room. The rooms were poorly isolated.
Probably why she got a cold.
Yeah, it was always very cold. Like, you could see your breath when you were breathing in winter because it was so cold. But she was convinced that, no, it was the bad feng shui. So, like, maybe, yeah, yes. I mean, as you say, in some cases, and especially maybe for urban planning, it might be something that's, like, a nice add-on. But I think there's also people who consider it something that's actually, like, they believe in it, or they think it's something that, like, directly, very much directly influences their life.
But then they wouldn't really say so in and like when they do the project, because
yeah, that's true.
Officially, government doesn't believe in feng shui. It's one of the superstitions that has to be erased.
Oh, okay.
I think so. It's, you cannot put that in like official circumstances.
Okay, fair enough.
Even though it's probably still very strong.
Okay. Like, we already talked about socialism. Do you have anything else to say about how the political system affects urban design? Because you wrote that down as a point, but...
Yes. I think one of the other interesting thing with urban design and urban planning is that it reflects society, and it reflects therefore also like political systems, when these political systems have a strong impact on society. Like, I wouldn't say it's that obvious in Europe. Maybe it is. But in China, I'm pretty sure that the fact that everything is planned and has been planned for so long, and you know, I was talking about the top-down approach, makes it so that cities are always, you know, organized. You can see and feel like it's organized by the government. You can feel the fact that there's no tradition of private ownership of land, because there is no little patches of land and little houses that form up this neighborhood and forms up the city. It will be always like, okay, we're going to build these apartment buildings and we're going to make 20 of them. Each of them is going to have 60 floors. And then there's going to be next one. There's going to be highway. And then the next one. Mm. Everything, the scale is so big. And it's always, you know, because it's cheaper to do things as big as whole than like two little things. But if you compare with others, like when I was in Taiwan, I realized that, you know, Taiwan is also culturally very Chinese. And you can have, can't deny they have a strong link, cultural link. But you can feel that in Taiwan, they have the tradition of private property. Okay. And you can feel this in the city, because when you go around the cities, I mean, I've been there only for a week, but you can see like all these little squares, like this little house and this little building is like basically evolved from this house. And then there's this other one there.
Yeah.
And it's, they also have the big apartment building that was built when town was developing super fast. But you feel like, okay, they couldn't, you know, there was this building there. So they had to like make the road about around it, because it could just expropriate this person. And when I went to the Taiwanese countryside, I can see the whole countryside as patches of like squares of land.
Yeah.
And you can visually see private property, where and you realize that in China, when you go to the countryside, you see like fields and everything. Then you see villages that are usually arranged in rows.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they were done so when they were collectivized. So now they're pretty much like rows of concrete buildings. Yeah. Some of, like, in, of course, you still have traditional villages, but not, like, it's not the norm. Mm-hmm. And the, and you realize it impacts the landscape, and it also impacts the city, and you get the feel of the city as well.
And, like, I mean, I noticed it when I was in Shanghai, and it's the same in Beijing, that I think it's, like, streets are, like, one street to another is, oh, it's always 90 degrees. So you can follow a street for, like, sometimes hours if you walk, and it's going to be straight. Like, and I came back to Europe and I was super confused, because I was used to streets running, like being parallel to each other. So I knew that if I was on this street for even half an hour, and like when I started, this one street would be parallel to this street, I could walk half an hour on this one street and then I could turn right and I would still end up on the street that used to be next to it, right? Yeah. Because it would always, like, everything would always be like that. And then I moved to France, right? Like when we were studying in Le Havre, and all of a sudden streets were like running any way possible again. And like you would walk along a street and you would think, oh, maybe if I turn left here, there's going to be that other street, because it used to be like on my left before. But because the streets don't go, like, aren't straight, and like they're like, there's no like 90 degrees like between like when two streets cross, it's like complete, like it feels like a complete mess when you come back.
Exactly. And that's probably because our cities evolved organically and like also less rapidly than here, where they just like evolve, they don't let it evolve organically. That's my point. Like, it doesn't evolve by itself, and just not gonna put the street because they need it. They're just gonna put the street first, and they put the buildings, and because they're anticipating that in five years there's gonna be so many people coming into Beijing, so they have to add the street. So it's, I mean, they do things because they're trying to be efficient, and I think it's probably the most efficient way, but it's probably not the best way in the end, because at some point the development's gonna slow down and they're gonna realize that what they will value is probably gonna be more like livability and accessibility to like public transportation, and they will not gonna be happy to walk so much hours to get there.
Yeah.
And but it's happening so fast, the urbanization process, that they can't really do anything about it.
They don't have the time to think about a lot of things. Like, they only have time to think about the most important and pressing issues.
It's just like a mechanical construction of city. They build cities like they product produce objects, manufacture objects, think. And you can see if you go around China, you see the same model of the city building built thousands and thousands of times. Because once they develop this efficient apartment building, it's going to be built in 200,000 times in several cities around China, and it's going to be the same one. And because it has to answer to the demand, it's really strong. So it's probably better to do it that way. I mean, it makes sense to do it that way.
It's not like a wrong decision or anything.
Really scary because it uniformizes every city in this country that's like a continent, and it's scary to see that in the south and the north and the in the west, and like people are different because they're not the same ethnicities, but they live in places that are completely the same. Even the sidewalk is the same, or like you know, it's like sometimes it's a bit disturbing.
Yeah,
and that's because they have this conception of the city, like, you know, they produce cities. They just produce it.
Oh yeah.
They produce a neighborhood. They don't like let it evolve.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the time.
Can I ask something there? Because you mentioned public transportation. Mm-hmm. Public transportation in Beijing is a problem, and I was writing about how car ownership in Beijing is. Like, it doesn't always seem to make sense because you have one person per car and then you've got all these traffic jams.
Mm.
And it seems like there's too many cars for the city and people should be using public transportation.
Mm.
But then at the same time, I can empathize because at rush hour, the metro is completely crammed. And buses will be stuck in traffic and will also be completely crammed. So if I'm like, if I have the choice between being stuck in traffic in my own vehicle and being stuck in traffic, like in this bus that's like, full with people, then I'd probably go for my own car. But do you think, is there any theory on what Beijing should have done differently? Like what the city could have done?
I think it's a good point because it really illustrates the fact that I was saying right in the beginning that China is facing the challenges of urbanization at the same time. Like it's facing the challenge that everyone's getting a car and the challenge that like it should develop public transportation and like kind of at the same time. And like, all the options are being developed at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have the time to first do this, then they get 20 years, then after 20 years, another problem comes up. It's just like they're developing like crazy the public transportation, like even in Beijing right now.
Yeah, that's true.
New metro lines are under construction and every year new open. And still, as soon as they're open, people just rush in.
Yeah, that's
true. Where are these people coming from? And they just like rush in and rush in. So I think they shouldn't like, they're transitioning to like, they're trying to transition to like more public transportation, so greener, less pollution and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not enough. So they have also to develop the car because more and more cars are still coming on the system, on the traffic network. So I don't think there's a miracle solution. Like Beijing should have done something about it.
So it's a bit there's no feasibility. Like there's hardly anything else they could have done. They didn't really have a choice.
There's nothing that we did that they could have done.
Okay.
The thing that's interesting now is to see, because they're facing this challenge that's kind of unique.
Mm.
And so they're going to have to find solutions, and they're probably already finding some right now.
Mm.
And then it's going to be interesting to see what like innovation is going to take place in public transportation in China, because I'm sure some person will have an idea about specific to China, and it will actually, you know, that's when you have these new situations that you have innovations. So I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about the speed of urbanization or the urban development in China, because it brings new challenges. So it's very stressful, but also it's very exciting, and you get to see what's being created.
Mm.
And then you can think about it. Maybe we could apply this back in Europe, actually, when it's been created here. You know?
Is this something that's likely to happen in India as well? Like, because there's urbanization in India as well, but it's not. Is it likely to be the same speed at some point if you consider the economic development of the country?
I think in India, it's like the economic development follows a path that's a bit different than the one in China.
Mm.
And like, even if it's fast, it's not. They don't have the government doesn't have the capacity to like control that much what's happening in cities, in economies and stuff. Like laws about urban planning, about transportation in India are not being decided at the central level. It's more like each government, each state, because it's a federal system.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, if they want to do something that's nationwide, like with a big urban policy, it's going to be really hard. So I think in India, it's probably going to be more chaotic and less efficient. And it's going to take a longer time to develop. which is a bad thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's probably going to be more adapted to each state and city's needs.
Okay.
Sure. So in the long term, but this like implies only my opinion. Mm. I think in the long term, maybe Indian urbanization is probably going to be more healthy.
Okay.
But in the meantime, they don't get people out of poverty that quick, okay, like China does. So, I mean, in the, some way China's development is more efficient, but in India, it's probably, you know, people are going to suffer for a longer time, but it's, in the end, it's probably going to be healthier.
In terms of like livability, sure, or
yeah,
how would you define healthy?
Like cities would probably, because as soon as you go slower, then you do less errors, right? Mm. I mean, I'm not saying errors are not being done in Indian but like, I mean, it's more like if you take time, you have to take time in India because there's so much process and sometimes it's a bit inefficient because there's so much steps and administrative steps. I'm not just an expert, but like, I'm pretty sure to do the project, you need so many people's signatures, and it's probably not efficient that way. But then it leaves space for like NGOs to protest about it and like, maybe like, oh, in China, the slum would have been destroyed immediately, but in India, you have 10 years because this guy is suing someone, and, you know? and it's, you know, there's still some democracy in India. It's kind of known for it. So, I mean, at some point, maybe the slum will be saved in the end. Where China would have been just destroyed in 2 months, you know, right?
Yeah.
So in the end, they'll be like, oh, okay, these people still live in a slum, but maybe in 10 years, the slum will actually be a nice neighborhood. And because it stayed there, it would have a better like street grid and more livability and like little houses instead of big condominiums and stuff like this.
Okay.
I'm not saying it's better. I'm saying it's different. That's what's interesting also in comparing both of them. It's very nice.
I mean, it's also something that's going to be interesting in, I don't know, maybe 20 years, 30 years, when hopefully both people in Indian and Chinese cities are at the level, like economic level, where they can worry about livability, right? Because if you worry about getting food and having like sewage systems, then like livability is not like, I mean, that's a basic, very basic livability problem, but
public transportation is not that priority anymore.
Yeah, exactly. But like, I mean, 20, 30 years, it's going to be interesting how like the two different countries turn out.
Yeah. And definitely.
Okay, anything else that you think would be, I think because we're already at like almost an hour, so I think maybe if you pick one more of your topics.
Maybe the mention by the Chinese leader Xi Jinping recently that he said in a speech that he didn't want any more weird architecture. You know, like people, I mean, Chinese cities are developing super fast. We told that hundreds of times. And sometimes, you know, you have big architectural projects of towers, hundreds of meters high, and one of them has a really weird shape. Weird, you know, it happens.
I mean, we should probably say this. Like, when we look out of the window right now, we literally see a building that is supposed to be formed like the Olympic torch.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a building that's formed like
fire.
Like a flame or something.
Yeah, flame, exactly. I mean, this kind of architecture has been called weird architecture by Xi Jinping, the leader of China, who said he would disapprove of any further big weird architecture project. Thing is that it's a very broad concept.
Yeah.
And this has at the same time, it's nice. We don't want weird architecture either because it's that's the debate. Like most people say, okay, like we have to be serious about it. We're being considered as fool by the world because we have stupid like ugly buildings, but. At the same time, as when people are afraid to do weird architecture, they're going to end up with basically endless boxes of concrete because people are just going to think, we shouldn't design weird architecture because it's not good.
And the same thing is already very much of the same. Like, you have so many apartment buildings already that in China that are so much the same that I don't think it's a bad thing to have like a kind of like funny building in between at some point.
Yeah, I know. And like the... This declaration was really debatable because at the same time, it's like our cities have to be, you know, world class and, you know, we have to have a New York and something like that. But at the same time, saying something like that in a country where you're so afraid of sometimes of authority and you don't really know when it's going to come on you if you do something wrong, then people maybe will not take the risk and that it might kill any architectural innovation.
Okay.
you know, when you do have innovation, it's the principle of innovation. You try something new, and sometimes it's a failure, and sometimes it's good, and it becomes like an innovation.
Yeah.
It's being taken, like, reproduced, and then it develops. But if you kill innovation from the beginning because you're afraid of having a potential failure, then you might end up with like less daring and interesting projects that could potentially become something really nice.
Yeah.
So this is also an impact of, like, you know, politics, and it's also an example of, like, you know, how political leaders actually have a strong impact on urban planning and architecture in China, I think.
But do you think there's more weird architecture in Europe because we have democracies?
Well, we have innovation, like, I think we had our fair, like, amount of weird architecture, but it's just, like, it wasn't on the same scale. We're not building, like, 100,000 to 200 meters towers or something like that. But, I mean, I cannot think of any right now.
I mean,
Think of weird of buildings that are not super ugly because they were built in the 60s and they're, like, really funny with, like, round windows and stuff.
I mean, I guess, but, for example, you have, like, the cucumber in London that might be considered weird. I'm not sure.
Oh, yes.
And then, like, the atom thing in Brussels. I'm not sure if that's, like, supposed to be art.
We have our share, but, like, he's just not the same scale. So.
Okay, yeah.
And in China, it's just like, I thought this quote also was interesting because it's just like such a statement against weird architecture has so much under it. Like, how can politicians, it's more than art, just urban planning, it's like, how can politicians decide what's weird and not weird, right? And then have to, like, have this official idea of what's beautiful and what's not beautiful, what's aesthetic. And once politicians start saying what's beautiful and what's not beautiful, what's wrong and what's good, I mean, it's just, I feel it's just dangerous. But in this.
Can I ask something? Like, as you mentioned, like, international pressure, in how far or how is internationalization of China changing urban planning? Because you mentioned that, like, there's people, like, Chinese people feel like the need to have their own New York, and there's always there's a huge emphasis on saying how international Shanghai is, because it's supposed to be a good thing, and everyone always says it's very good to be international and to speak English and stuff like that. Does that impact urban planning, except for stuff like this?
It does impact a lot of urban planning. They tend to model their strategies on international. At the same time, they have a kind of a schizophrenic discourse, because at some point they said, like, they, you know, China can do, we have a tradition of old urban planning, we've been designing cities for millenniums, but then they're not applying it to modern style cities. Now, it's either like they had inspiration from socialism when they were a hardcore communist, and now there's more like what they call the international style. It's just like, it's more basically more American style building. They look up to big glass towers and financial, like, because a city, like a building or a city layout, is really like represents the main thought or the main ideology behind the society that builds it at that time. So now Shanghai is looking to become a financial center, so it's really looking to become a New York, so it's building like a New York.
That's true.
And
because, you can see that.
Yeah, because it wants to, and it wants to give this image of being the next New York. But, like, I don't know if this applies, like, if they find it good, like the people, if they think they actually agree with it. I can't really tell that, but I mean, international architecture, international urban planning is definitely looked up to, I think, in China. And maybe, like, the concepts of, like, green cities and smart cities are really trendy.
Yeah.
And the thing is that the government wants to apply them directly.
Yeah.
But sometimes you just have also to let them develop.
So do you think there's potential there for, like, sustainable cities in China, that, like, in the speed that the cities are developing, you also have the chance to try out concepts for sustainability that you wouldn't be able to apply in Europe because cities aren't growing that much? Like, here you have districts, complete districts developing. You could technically say this is something that's sustainable, and then you can try it right away.
Yes,
if it doesn't work for the next district, you don't use it.
Yeah, definitely. The fact that cities spring out of nowhere in China is actually an opportunity. Like, lots of companies actually coming from Europe are have contracts to build completely new neighborhoods and build new cities in China. But there's a limit on it. Like, either it's to experience their own technologies, and it's really nice because they can build a, you know, energy efficient neighborhood in China somewhere. But it's not really going to help the whole city.
Mm.
And sometimes it's still the beginning of, like, fully ecological, zero emission kind of neighborhoods. They're still always a bit kind of not really working. And the other thing is that even if we succeed in China, how is it going to help us
back home? That's true.
Because what we have to design back home is how to make our city already existing energy efficient and zero emission. We're not going to raise, like, destroy them and build new ones.
Because we're not Chinese.
Yeah. So, exactly. So, I mean, it's nice to experience new technologies and have the opportunity to actually innovate here. And maybe you can find innovation and bring them back to Europe, but, like, there's still this limit that the context is completely different.
Yeah, that's true.
We're not going to build cities out of nowhere in Europe. We may, but not enough to... We're not going to replace our cities by these.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool, fair enough. Anything else you think I missed that's important?
I think we pretty
famous
much...
Famous last words.
I think we pretty much got to all the topics I wanted to talk about, and I hope I was not too much messy.
We will get feedback, right? So we've gotten bad feedback in the past, we've gotten good feedback in the past. Again, just as essentially always, we encourage you to give us feedback. This is something new we tried out, first time with a guest, and also first time in English. We'd be very happy to hear from you guys how you liked it, if you thought it was a good idea, or if we should just switch back to just doing, like, podcasts in German with just Niels and me, because we don't like change. please comment, mention us on Twitter and tell us what you think. One last question I have for you. I probably should have told you this before. No, you're completely unprepared. Do you have any, like, resource or website where you think it would be worth, like, looking through articles or following this website if you're people are interested in how urban China develops and, like kind of, like, keeping up with this topic?
I actually have some, but the only two I'm thinking about are in Chinese.
Okay.
So, I mean, it might not be very useful. Otherwise, I don't.
Okay.
Sorry.
What about the place where you did your internship? Didn't you, like...
Oh, yeah, the place where I did my internship, it was more of a research agency on urban areas in China. It's called Sinopolis. Sinopolis. And they regularly post stuff about urban China. It could be anything.
Mm.
Sometimes it's more sociological. Sometimes it's just a case study of the city or this technology or this new regulation. And they post stuff about it on their website, so Sinopolis, or on their Facebook page.
Okay. I mean, we can put the links in the show notes so that
you
can find.
So this is nice, but it's, you know, it's not very... It's very, sometimes very anecdotic.
Mm.
If you want a comprehensive understanding of all of what's happening in China, it's not going to be enough. But it's probably good because it's going to link out and branch out to other sources.
Okay, fair enough. That sounds
good. It's good that you brought it up.
It's in English and in French, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, like, if anyone wants to practice their French skills on top of English, then that might be a good place to start.
Yeah, I think they're changing their website, and it's going to be only in English afterwards.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm not sure. Some of the articles might only be in French. I can't remember.
I mean, we'll see. Okay, then thanks a lot for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you guys for listening. Again, please give us feedback. And until next time. We're already in the middle of planning what's happening, but we can't tell you yet because we really don't know. So, until later. Bye.